One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
In the age of online retail, buying a car should be no different. That's why Carvana invented a brand new way to buy a car that's 100% online. Without leaving the comfort of your couch, you can browse and buy from their selection of almost 20,000 cars. And once you've made a purchase, your car comes to you, delivered right to your door. Or you can pick it up from one of their coin-operated car vending machines. All of Carvana's cars come with a 7-day return policy, ensuring you get a car that fits perfectly with your life. Not happy? Exchange it or return it for a full refund. And with its dedication to customer service, it's why hundreds of thousands of customers have ditched the dealership and given Carvana 4.7 stars in customer satisfaction. So check out the nation's fastest-growing auto retailer at Carvana.com.
Napa know-how.
At Napa Auto Parts stores and Napa Auto Care centers, get a $25 prepaid Visa card when you get any Napa automotive battery. It's the best deal for some of the best batteries from some of the best car people around. But we might be a little partial. Anywho, pick up any Napa automotive battery and save $25. Do it yourself or have it done for you. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
At participating Napa Auto Parts stores and Napa Auto Care centers, while supplies last, offer ends 8/31/20.
Well, Maisie, you're in my...
Hello, everyone, and welcome back for a brand new edition of Collider Ladies Night. I am beyond thrilled for this one because I have Emily Mortimer here with me. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I am good. It's so nice to see you again. You've got so much cool stuff coming up right now.
Yes, I do actually. I feel very proud of the movie that's coming out now, Relic. It's good. Yeah,
I've watched it twice now, and I was talking with we do a horror show called The Witching Hour that Natalie was actually just on, and I was talking to my co-host about the movie, and both of us loved it the first time around. But I think it hits even harder when you know what it's getting at, and you watch it a second time. It just makes that pit in your stomach ache even more.
I agree. I saw it the second time. I saw it was at Sundance, and I there was partly also because there was an audience and all that. But I really was just staggered the second time by the kind of audacity of it, apart from anything else.
Nothing else. Yeah. So we're going to go back to the very, very beginning here. And one of the things I always love asking about first is, do you remember the performance, the movie, the show, anything at all that made it click in your mind that I have to be an actor?
Oh, no. I remember a moment when I did always kind of, you know, do little play. I did little plays. I was a very, very shy child. I was an incredibly, ridiculously shy child. And I would get sort of embarrassed even if my teacher sort of called on me to say something in class, or if someone said my name, I would blush. And so I wasn't what you might think of as a sort of natural performer, but I did have a very active sort of inner life, I suppose, and was always kind of acting out things in the garden to my parents or to myself. And I would act out anything. I was a television advert, so I would act out like adverts for washing powder that I'd seen on the television or cookery programs or anything, and I'd make them watch me. But the thought of being watched by anyone other than my parents in the garden at home was horrifying to me. But I did join the debate class at school, and I had to do a debate about I was speaking on anarchy and the you know, speaking for anarchy basically, and I was about 13 or 14 or something like that, and I remember sitting in the audience and feeling just so scared and waiting for my turn and feeling like my heart was just going to explode out of my chest. I was so scared, and then I couldn't possibly do it. Like, there was just no way I was going to be able to do this thing. And then walking up onto the stage and something, and putting my little speech on the lectern, and then just something somehow, like it was like a hand reached out from the sky or something and told me it was okay and took me. And I actually enjoyed it. I went from feeling more horrified than I've ever felt about anything to suddenly like, oh, this is okay. This is cool. And it was almost like that was the only way I could be kind of brave, was to just force myself to do the most terrifying thing I could have ever imagined. And then I was okay. But it was the in-between things, like putting my hands up in class or going to children's parties and being picked on by the entertainer told to come and help do the trick. That was my idea of absolute hell.
Still gives me anxiety.
Oh, my God. Because they'd always tease you. They'd always make comments about what you were wearing. And you'd have to sort of laugh along with the joke, but you just want to die. And they were always kind of mildly abusive, and you were always the butt of the joke. But I would spend my life getting out of going to children's parties in case I was picked on by the entertainer, or once there hiding from the entertainer so I wouldn't be so it was just the realization that I could overcome my shyness in some weird way by really just doing something extremely public and out there, and suddenly kind of almost becoming another person in doing so. And that was a kind of real relief. And I think that feeling has sort of is what then I got hooked on. I got hooked on that feeling. It was like, you can't be shy when you're doing that. And it kind of gets you out of yourself somehow.
Oh, for sure. I can totally understand that. I'll never forget my first TV junket interview. And it was almost like when I sat down in the chair, I feel like I kind of blacked out, but yeah. I did the job. And then after that, it was fine.
You can't believe that you could have got through it.
So you hit the point where you know you want to be an actor. But do you remember what made you switch from thinking I want to be an actor to, wow, this can really be a career for me?
I went to university and I studied Russian and English. I didn't study theater at all, but I did act all the time. I did plays all the time. And I did a play at college, and it was a production of Kafka's The Trial. It was it had been adapted by Stephen Berkoff into a sort of theater production, and actually it was directed by Tom Hooper, who then went on to become a big Oscar-winning movie director. But an agent happened to come and see the play, whose daughter was at the university that I was at, and she just had been visiting her daughter, and she came to see the play, and she wrote a note and put it in my pigeonhole, my cubbyhole in college, and said, I'd like to represent you. And I suddenly had an agent. And so I was getting work pretty much right off the bat. I got a job just before I even did my final, finished my finals and finished my degree. And so I was working immediately. But I guess what happened was I was working immediately, but thinking always, I'm going to do something serious with my life. I'm going to justify all the money that my parents have spent on my very expensive education. This isn't forever. This is just a little bit. And I was also doing things that I wasn't particularly proud of and that weren't very good, and that I wasn't very good in. Very often in a sort of crinoline and a wig that looked like it had been sort of dropped from outer space onto my head. In some terrible sort of period thing, and just cringing and sort of thinking this isn't for me. I've got to do something serious and proper and justify my education, as I say. And it wasn't until I carried on like that for a few years and getting work and making money, but it was none of it very, it wasn't making me particularly happy and I didn't feel particularly proud of it. And none of it was anything that anyone would have ever remembered. And then I met my husband, Alessandro Nivola, a very accomplished and brilliant actor. And he was the first person who said to me, you better sort of shit or get off the pot with this thing, because you can't really be half-hearted. You can't be sort of thinking, oh, I'll just do this for a little while about acting, because it's like, it's a passion and it has to be. And because it's really hard, it's a really hard life. So I don't understand what your sort of vibe is. It's like you're keep saying you're embarrassed about doing all these stupid jobs and you've got to do something more important with your life or whatever, but you're still doing it. So it's like either decide you're going to do it and you're going to commit and you're going to do things you are interested in and passionate about, or don't, and go off and do whatever it is that you feel like you want to do. And it was kind of amazing, this pep talk that happened quite early on in our relationship before we were married. And I thought to myself, he's right. And it is a really exposing and vulnerable making job. And it takes so much to do it. And therefore do it with intention and do it, you know, with meaning and try to make the best of it that you can and give it your all, you know, and don't just sort of wait for something better to come along. So I thought, I'll see what happens if I do that for a year. And then I'll see if I still how I feel. So I decided I was just going to really take it and myself seriously. And the first job I got after that decision was made was a film called Lovely and Amazing, which is still one of the things I'm sort of proudest of, actually. And I feel was a real milestone for me, and was really, I count that movie as the kind of beginning of my career, in a way, of the career that I feel like I was kind of in charge of.
What kind of sex do you have with your boyfriend? You heard me.
That's private.
You're absolutely right. Forgive me, I was just trying to get a feel for what you find sexy.
Why don't we try reading the scene?
Yeah, let's just do this. Okay.
Is it difficult, though, that early on in your career? Because I even still have this mentality a little where I just need to, like, work all the time. And it's very difficult for me to say no to something. So when you're first kind of starting out and you have to pass on something that just doesn't feel right to you, is it, I don't know, do you have to explain decisions like that to your team? And what do you do if they try to nudge you in the other direction?
Well, Maisie, you're in my... you're so welcome, but Megan asked all these questions much better than me. I think it's really important to now, looking back on it, I was just learning. I was learning how to act. I was learning my craft. I was learning how to sort of be in things with other people. I was working out who I was. And so it was really important to go to do those jobs and to kind of, you know, not necessarily, you know, feel in charge of yourself or have a kind of plan and to just like, but at the time I felt, yeah, I did feel sort of, oh God, and at the beginning, I think you do need to just keep taking what you'll get, you know, you're lucky to be employed and it's, everything is learning and you just hope that at some point you meet someone that, you know, or something happens that can get you somewhere that that feels like it's your place. But at the beginning, you just you're out there and you're just learning and you should just take what you can get and do it and not have this kind of I think it comes back to being this sort of shy kid. I would just feel so embarrassed about sort of the idea of people seeing these things. And I would just dread anyone saying, oh, I saw you in that thing on the TV. And I just be like, oh, no, please. I'd much rather no one did. But now looking back on it, you just do it and take pride in the fact that you're doing it. And then at a certain point, you hope that you're able to start working at understanding what kind of a performer you are, what interests you, what your, you know, strengths are, and what doesn't interest you, and generally what interests you is what you're going to be good at. When I got the script for Lovely and Amazing, and I read it, and I just felt like, oh my goodness, this is to be part of this story and to be helping to tell this story. That's what I want. That's the kind of stuff I want to do. That's the kind of work I want to do. And I've really got to try and get this job. And I did, amazingly.
Having that shyer mentality, I do wonder, when you were first starting out, was there any question that might have seemed like a silly question about the way a film set worked that you were afraid to ask back then that, you know, now you wish up-and-comers would have the nerve to ask?
One of the first jobs I ever had, which was a big movie called The Ghost in the Darkness, I was Val Kilmer's wife, but I got eaten by a lion very early on in the proceedings. But I remember my first day on that job, and there was this huge kind of, I was in Africa, and it was all about man-eating lions in Africa. And I'd arrived, and I had walked onto this set full of, you know, thousands of extras, and I had to be standing there with my sort of baby and having come to meet Val Kilmer, and it was quite overwhelming. And I remember the director coming up to me and saying, after my first take, and saying, oh, that was really, you know, good. You did really well. Well done. You've got a slightly sleepy left eye. So could you just try and open it a little bit? And I was like, oh yeah, sure. Definitely. Of course. No. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, really well. Yeah, completely. I do have slightly weird eyes. And so he went off and I was left there thinking, wait, I don't know how to open my sleepy eyes. That's the whole point. Like that, I don't know how to do that. So I'm going to have to maybe close the other eye a little bit to make it like, and then they were saying, turn over, you know, rolling, turn over, and all these thousands of extras. And I was like, all I was doing was trying to make my eyes the same size and close one of them to, and if you look at the shot, and it's just so funny, if you know, it's just like, what is that woman doing? But I think I learned really early on from that you just sort of don't pay attention to shit like that. Like, just either don't pay attention to it or say, you know, that's not gonna work. You know, you have to not be too obliging, and people completely are able to handle it. You know, you just have to sort of, if something, don't, however shy you are, however nice you are, don't prioritize pleasing people over what happens between action and cut. You know, you just have to be in that moment, in that world, and not thinking about anything to do with your tiny eyes or your evening mouth or any of it.
I feel like that's the first thing I'm going to do after this chat is just like, go look and see what happened. I don't even understand that. There is no way I can cover your filmography and not talk about Scream, which is my second favorite franchise of all time. Number one being Jurassic Park. So I am a big fan of, and everybody on Collider knows this, but I am a big believer that Alessandro's character in that does not get enough credit for what he means to the franchise overall.
Oh my God, you need to discuss this with him.
I have like a big theory about it. I find that Billy encapsulates what makes the franchise churn, and it's the constant repetition of seeing somebody else make a mistake, but just human nature and intrigue in that kind of science just drawing you to making the same mistake again, and that's why he took the raptor eggs.
Okay, that
he had Alan right there and still did it.
You need to write a dissertation on this.
I probably should. I think there's a paragraph or two floating around out there, but I feel like I could write many more words on that. But Scream 3 is hands down another one that I absolutely adore. So before you jumped into that one, were you a fan? And were there any, I guess, nerves associated with jumping into this franchise that was one of the biggest horror franchises out there at the time?
Well, luckily for me, I didn't really know that. I just went along to this audition because my agent said there's a part in this movie, Scream 3. And I did, of course, know that there was a Scream 1 and a Scream 2, but I wasn't sort of like clued in to like what a big deal it was at all. And I wasn't like horror and those kind of movies were not my thing. And so I don't even know that I'd barely seen, I don't think I'd even seen them. And I went for this audition as this, you know, very ambitious girl from Bakersfield, California, who, and I was just like, there's no way on earth that I'm going to get this part. Like, there's just no way. I mean, I'm a girl from Oxfordshire. I've just got here to visit my boyfriend and I'm not going to get this. But, and I went in there and all the more reason, I mean, I was just like, there was queues of these very kind of glamorous blonde sort of LA, what you think of as LA chick sort of beautiful girls queuing up for this part. And I was just like, there's no way I'm going to get this. But I think that I get there's something that happens to me when the chips are really stacked against something or against me in a moment. I quite like it. I just have a quite good attitude to that. I don't really have much pride to begin with. So when there's a moment where you're really sort of nothing's expected of you by anyone and you're almost certainly going to fail, I come into my own. And so I did this audition and I got the job and it was Wes Craven. And I do really have him to thank, because that was before Lovely and Amazing, actually. And I wouldn't have got Lovely and Amazing if it hadn't been for the fact that I'd already been in a movie and done an American accent. And he was a real advocate of mine, and I loved working with him. I just think he was the most gentle, intelligent, quiet, softly spoken guy, but with just such a great humor and intelligence and such a kind person. And he really sort of took to me for some reason. And that I did a Paris Je T'aime, you know, these filmmakers had made little shorts set in Paris, and it was the first one, and he chose me for that. And and I did this little short with him, and then filmmakers were approached and asked to do dress up their kind of music or whatever, I don't know, as movies, famous movie stars. And and he chose me and dressed me up as Audrey Hepburn for the New York Times. And I felt like he was a sort of mentor, and he promoted me, and he definitely paved the way in a way for people like Nicole Holofcener and others to feel good about costuming and things.
I love hearing that. I admire him so much. So if he felt that way about your work, it does not surprise me at all that I'm a big fan of yours as well. Moving forward to Dahl and M right now, what would you say you liked the most about being on a set like that as a creator, a writer, and a producer, and not just being in front of the lens?
How long have you two been together? Oh, no, we're not together. Sorry.
I'm married.
Yeah.
But we would have been when we were younger. We'd totally
up for that. Yeah.
No judgments for anything like that. No. I've got loads of friends who've had.
That's girlfriend. Yeah.
Should I get the pudding?
First of all, just making something with my best friends, and what we've been trying to write together for about 10 years before that thing happened, but we'd never really done anything. We just sort of sat in cafes and Starbucks all over the world and sort of she would always come to wherever I was filming, and we would just go and sit in the local nearest Starbucks and pretend to write something, but really we just gossip, and it was just an excuse for her to come and visit me wherever I was. Now she's much too grand, and I'm the one visiting her. But then she was the one visiting me, and we decided we were going to write together as a kind of excuse to just keep talking to each other and keep up our codependency as much as we possibly could. And as I said, she would fly to various locations and we would write in various Starbucks around the world, but not write anything. And then we would run up just tremendously huge telephone bills, just gossiping. And then finally our husband pretending that we were writing a screenplay. And then finally we just had to come up with something, because it was like the screenplay that Jack Nicholson wrote in The Shining. It was like, it didn't exist. And 5 years had gone by and all this money on airplane tickets and phone bills had been racked up. And we came up with this idea, which was just a very simple one, out of desperation. It was like, okay, we've got to write something now, come on. And it was like, yeah, what happens if you make your best friend, your childhood best friend, your personal assistant? And the answer is everything goes horribly wrong. And it really tickled us, that notion of these two women who are, you know, who are both the same age, the same sort of socioeconomic backgrounds. Have known each other since childhood, and yet one is kind of acting as the other one's servant in a way, to all extents and purposes. And that kind of dynamic and how that kind of interfaces with a friendship that's, you know, and completely equal, was really kind of fascinating to us and made us laugh. And we wrote the show, and within about a year, we wrote a little teaser, basically, that we acted in my trailer on the newsroom. I was doing the newsroom at the time, and we got our friend Azza, who directed it, Azazel Jacobs, who's a fantastic independent filmmaker, to come and just shoot us in my trailer, just inventing things and sort of improvising. We had this idea that we liked, but we just sort of made up these scenes. And then he shot a bit of it in the house that I was renting at the time while I was doing the newsroom, edited it together. And it was 20 minutes of what ended up being the first episode of this thing. And it was so cool, because it was just bringing your best friend to work with you every day. And then also bringing all of our families, like both of our sets of children, all four of our children are in it. Our husbands are both in it. Both of our mothers are in it. Everybody that you love most in the world suddenly was there with you on the job, which is normally not the case. It's normally that you leave them all and go off somewhere and feel lonely without them. And this time they all came too. And that show, in a way, is almost like a family album, like a photograph album in a way. It's like this incredible thing that we'll all have forever, that you know, I don't know, it's just sort of record of something.
I love that. It makes me wish that you guys could make some more of it.
I know, me too. We really want to. We're trying. I don't know that it will be exactly Doll and M, but there might be something else that we're sort of concocting.
I do wonder, though, because it's very difficult to find now. Is there any reason it's not available on, I don't know, a streaming service or something?
No, yes. No, not really. It was just like it fell in between all sorts of stools, and it just didn't, because it was Sky and HBO. Mm-hmm. There was all this kind of boring red tape that meant that it isn't really being officially streamed by any of the big platforms at the moment, which is so crazy. But we're working on it. I think it's going to happen. It's going to come back into the sort of onto people's laptops and screens soon.
I am happy to hear that. As we creep closer to Relic here, I want to talk a little bit about working with Martin Scorsese, because you jump into a movie like that, I imagine there have to be expectations that come with working with a director like him. So what were those expectations, and how did he exceed them?
Walking onto his sets, it's like walking into church or something, really. It's like you could hear a pin drop. And everybody is just knows their place. Everything is very, there is a kind of ritual to the whole thing. It's like all these people who have been working with him for years and years and adore him and are adored by him. But everybody from the kind of the person that's bringing you your cup of tea to the sound person, to the costume designer, you know, Sandy Powell, they're all, you know, at the absolute top of their game. I mean, they are all the most brilliant people in our industry. And to be surrounded by those people and to be able to have the benefit of their expertise is just, is so crazy. It's so wonderful. And it is really intimidating, but in the kind of best way. You just feel, I don't know, there's something about working with people who are so good at what they do and working with Martin Scorsese, who is so good at what he does, that it's sort of the nerves are, the terror and the horror of the situation is completely mitigated by the fact that they are so expert and so good and so, and you're, it's not sort of, they've chosen you because they want you or something, like it very quickly doesn't feel like, well, I mean, of course, in the back of my head, there's always a feeling of like, this is a mistake. Like this was a terrible mistake. This was some piece of paperwork got mixed up and I shouldn't really be here at all. Someone else called Emily should be here. But he really doesn't make you feel like that. You know, that's just the voices in your head. The reason that he makes movies is because he loves movies. He's a cinephile bar none, and so there's such enthusiasm for the process of making a film, and he's so ungrand about it, and every shot that he's creating, it's all like, oh, this is a show. He'll say, oh, you know, you're lying in this scene, so I'm going to put the camera above your head, because in every Hitchcock scene, when a character's lying or not telling the truth, the camera's looking down at them from higher than they are, and he just is getting such a kick out of it that you do too, and it sort of stops. It doesn't feel precious. It just feels very, you know, precise and good. And he has a great talent that the great filmmakers have of just somehow by some osmosis or something, like, you understand the world that you're in, that you understand the world that he's creating. And you know, kind of half your job is done, because he lets it be clear what the world is, and you can just enter it and go with it.
What is it like, especially when you describe, I think you use the word ritualistic for his set and his process and everything. So how is it going from something like Shutter Island to Hugo, where you have this very accomplished, experienced director working with new technology? Do you see a difference there?
Not really. He took it so in his stride, that technology. And as I said, it was basically part of the same thing, which is just the joy of it, the joy of being able to work with this technology and it makes him very ungrand. He's not grand at all. Even though there is this very extremely calm and precise set that is run like a sort of fine oiled machine. There's the joy in all the discoveries. And also, of course, you know, Hitchcock had made movies in 3D. And so it wasn't like he was doing anything particularly groundbreaking. He was just able to work with smaller cameras than they had.
So going from working with incredibly accomplished directors like Martin Scorsese, Wes Craven, you name it, to working with a first-time feature filmmaker on Relic with Natalie here, what was it about her that gave you the confidence that when I jump on that set, not only is she going to be a good filmmaker, but that's a pretty dark headspace to have to commit to for a while. But, you know, she'll take care of my needs on set, too.
I just knew from reading the script that she was a filmmaker. I just knew that she was somebody that had, like, they're talking about the world. Like, she had created a world, even just in the screenplay. It was so audacious. It was so bold. She just seemed in perfect charge of herself. She's very quietly spoken and very kind of gentle person. So it wasn't with any kind of you know, she wasn't wielding her power in any way, but she was just calmly centered and just clearly knew what she was on about from the word go. And I just felt really safe in her hands. And I felt, and also she's really perfectionistic. Like she was not going to move on unless she was happy with the take or the shot or whatever it was. And she was a stickler. And I think that was a very kind of, that was a good sign. That was just that right from the word go. I was like, oh yeah, no, she's a perfectionist. You have to be a bit of a perfectionist.
I remember the toothbrush story from Sundance.
Yeah, exactly.
It's good to have that eye for detail, though, especially with something like this. As far as your characters go, I think we get such full versions of them in this 90-minute film. But just for you and for your prep work, do you have to come up with more backstory for Kay? Because now that I've seen the movie multiple times, I've gotten obsessed with the characters. And I'm like, well, like, what was her childhood like growing up? And what about her relationship with Sam? And who is Sam's father? I have all these questions now.
I know. No. Yes, me too. But we did have actually more backstory when we started shooting, and then in the end it got cut because it was sort of, and I think that was right, because really it's a sort of every man family. I think it's a tale that is, you know, as old as time. These three women, one of them is my mother, one of them is my daughter. I'm coming home to help her because she's sick and ailing, and eventually is going to die. But of course, life is more complicated than that, and relationships are more complicated than that. And I'm coming home because I love her, and also because I have some duty to her. She's my mother and she raised me. But it's fraught with kind of guilt and regret and confusion and pain. And my relationship with her has all those elements, and so does my relationship with my daughter. And I think it was right that you feel that, but that you don't have. I think to go into the whys and the wherefores of it was unnecessary, because as I said, I think that's pretty much every family and every relationship between mothers and daughters and daughters and mothers has elements of that, you know? And so, yeah, there was more backstory. I think I had been I'd had a career as at the UN. I was a human rights lawyer. I was quite a high powered, sort of quite, you know, career oriented woman. And I had, kind of relied on my mother when my daughter was in her childhood. And when I had got divorced, and I'd obviously had some kind of breakdown as a result of splitting up from the father of Sam, and had used my mother and father as a kind of as you know, had they had been basically rearing my kid for the few years where life got difficult, and so that had set up this kind of journey of psych, like kind of guilt and shame and regrets and gratitude too, and all that stuff. So, but I think it was good that actually didn't end up in the final movie, because as I said, I think we all understand difficult interfamiliar relationships. And once you get too specific, it makes it less like something you can relate to.
It definitely didn't need it, but after you've seen it multiple times, it's fun to kind of fill in those little blanks there. I love having that kind of information. I did want to ask you, and I'm going to put a big spoiler warning up on the screen, two spoiler questions. And, you know, this one's a little convoluted. I got into talking to Natalie about it, and I'm just curious from your perspective, what you have to have in your mind when you're working with this. It's like, I guess I'll call it the evil entity of the film, because I think it can be interpreted, you could look at it as like a supernatural creature in a sense, but it's also just like a very real human affliction. So when you read the script for the first time, what are some of the burning questions that you had for Natalie so that you could fully play what Kay is seeing at the time?
Gosh, you know, I didn't really have any questions, because to me, as somebody that has kind of gone through losing a parent and losing a parent who was old, my dad was old when he died. He was 85, but he was about 10 years ago, but he was so he was kind of dying of decrepitude in a way, old age. And he definitely had kind of cognitive like impairment towards the end, where I don't know whether it was exactly dementia, but I think it was a version of it where suddenly he was looking at me like he sort of didn't know me at times, you know, and that is such the most horrifying experience. It is so odd, as I'm sure anyone who's had to deal with that will agree, that it's scarier than kind of anything you could ever think of in a horror film or anything, when someone you know all your life and has reared you and raised you and never not looked at you with anything but love is suddenly looking at you like they don't really know you. That's horrifying, and it does feel almost like they've been taken over by some supernatural force or something. And it's, to me, that was all I needed to sort of think about. Like, it was that simple, really. It's just like what happens to us as we sort of decline and age and start to make our way towards death is sometimes really scary at first glance. And it is like having been taken over, or that the part of you that is the kind of the bit that feels the most sort of present and relatable has just kind of been, I don't know, hijacked. And so I really felt that was all I needed to sort of think about and draw on.
Yeah, the way you describe it is why this is the kind of movie that keeps me up at night, and not necessarily the jump scare slasher type, as much as I enjoy them. The other spoiler question I wanted to ask you was, shooting that final scene, the material with the puppet, just what was that like for you? Had you ever done anything like that before? That just seems wild to me.
No, it was amazing. I really felt incredibly, I didn't know what it was going to be like. I remember writing to a text to Bella after we'd finished that scene, and before she came for her little bit at the very end, and I was like, I've just spent all morning peeling a skin off my dead mother, or my, you know, I like, what is going on? But it was an extraordinary experience. It was like, when I read that scene, I felt like that was what sold me on the movie. As you know, when I got to the end of it, it had been beautifully written and constructed and full of amazing things all along. But then I got to that last section, I was like, wow, this is just so extraordinary, so bizarre, so outrageous and kind of audacious. And I like mad, like I've never thought of, or I've never seen anything like this. I've never even thought of anything like this before in my life. And yet it speaks to me. Like, yeah, I can really, I sort of, this, it's speaking to me. I get it. I get it. It's cool. I'm with it. And then when we shot it, I had that feeling too. I was like, this feels right. This feels like what it feels like, in a way, to help someone that you love die, and to help someone kind of shed. Again, it's a ritual. It was a ritualistic, you know, thing. It's like shed the kind of the sickness, shed their body, shed the thing that's holding them back and stopping them being able to make that sort of incredibly difficult but yet sort of beautiful journey to death. And very often, you know, people need their loved ones to help them make that journey. And there was something about that peeling off of the skin and the hair and this extraordinary ritual that felt both as horrifying as it really feels in real life to help someone die, and as beautiful and kind of cathartic in a way. And so I just think it's just an exquisite moment of movie making. And I was so proud and moved by it while I was doing it, and so proud to be a part of that.
You really should be. I think the headline of my review of Relic is that it's bound to be one of the best horror movies of the year. I just think it's something special when you take genre and you get at, you know, human truths that are very difficult to process, like what you guys do in this movie. So I cannot congratulate you enough on this one and everything you've accomplished over the course of your career. Emily, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. My daughter's clapping. She's clapping you more than me.
I hope you enjoyed.
Did you enjoy it?
And my job is done here.
Napa Know-How.
This month, Napa's got all kinds of motor oil deals that can save you some serious cash. Like a 5-quart jug of Napa Full Synthetic Motor Oil for just $16.49. With savings like that, you may start feeling like a VIP. But don't let it go to your head. These oil deals are for everyone. Quality parts, helpful people. That's Napa Know-How.
Napa Know-How.
General States pricing. Sales prices not include applicable state local taxes or recycling fees. Offer ends 8/31/20.
Stelio Chico Pitbull, Mr. 305, better said Mr. Worldwide, and I'm here to tell you about my new podcast, From Negative to Positive, brought to you by my friends over at State Farm. I believe that to have success, you got to play the game so that the game doesn't play you. You know, the biggest risk you take is not taking one. It's very important that you make sure that you make the most out of your money, especially when it comes to insurance. State Farm offers surprisingly great rates. They have great agents standing by helping you personalize your coverage. All this is backed up by award-winning, easy-to-use technology. It's a great price with an even greater service. When you want the real deal, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear, and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.